Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you The Enchanted Self with Dr. Barbara Becker-Holstein. Greetings and welcome, Barbara. How are you?
I'm good. Tell me, can you hear me clearly?
I can hear you. Your volume is a little bit low, but I can hear you.
Let's see. How's this? Is this better? That,
yes, it is.
Let's see. Better still or what?
Better still.
How's that? So let's see if it goes any further.
Okay.
Congratulations. I think that might be the most.
Yeah, that's fine.
I'll
get a little bit on my side as well. Congratulations for being on the cover and being the cover story of Filmmaker Life magazine.
It is. Is that a phone call coming in?
No, I just upped the volume on my end as well to boost your signal.
Oh, okay. All right. Yes, it is very exciting. I'm thrilled, let's say. It's something that I haven't felt as excited since doing some of the shows we did together in New York. Yeah,
uh-huh.
It's great.
And I love all the things you talk about were on the cover, where psychology meets filmmaking, empowering through screens, a vision for transformation. It's a wonderful cover.
Yes, it is. And did you find the secret in the cover? There's a secret. There's a hidden picture in the cover.
No,
and,
I didn't find it.
yeah. Well, maybe I shouldn't tell anyone what it really is, but it's there to represent some of the challenges and the years of being alive that people go through. So you'll find it at some point, or I'll tell you, you know, but I'll
okay.
keep it a secret just now.
I see faces on the right side of your head. There are faces
that,
look like drawings.
You got the secret, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And that's actually a picture of me from when I was about 18 or 19. I can't remember the whole story. What I do remember is that somebody was a student photographer training to be a professional. I don't think it was a person that I really knew before the picture or really after, but he asked if I would be willing to come up to his, wherever, his studio, and he would take the picture and I would get a copy, and that's exactly what happened. And and it's funny because I don't remember anything around it except walking in the street when I had the picture. And this was all in Manhattan. There's a whole story that goes with those couple of weeks. But walking in the street, and I kept looking at myself in the reflection every time I could. Because I was so happy. I was so happy because this was a picture where my hair looked just right. And I don't think that had ever happened to me before. It was like just one of those small miracles. But the story of why I was there for a couple of weeks is worth presenting because it ties into the whole sense of when we get a chance to transform ourselves and when we can have some sense of the vision of who we can be and when sometimes we have to throw it in the garbage, you know, that wasn't a particular train that we were going to take. So let me back up. I have finished my freshman year at, yeah, it's a good story, and maybe you'll have something that comes to your mind to piggyback. I had finished my freshman year at Smith College, which was in Massachusetts, a little bit in a small town. To me, I was not happy, and I was considering transferring because it was just not, it didn't have the beat I needed in life. And but I was also conflicted, and I also had not much to do. So someone must have told me that there were these warehouses, factories in Manhattan, in the district, the clothing district, where they would need models for a couple of weeks when it was buying season. And I honestly have lost that whole thread of who said what when, but I had nothing to do, and I was lying on my bed in Norwalk, Connecticut, just getting cranky. And I decided to go and see if I could get a job. So I put on my better clothes, and I went into the city, I'm sure by myself, because my mother and father were very involved with a small baby. They weren't going to come and drive me in or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you this part, I don't really clearly remember. I just know I did it. So I went to this factory and talked to a couple of people, and I guess they asked me to walk up and down a few times and try on a few coats. They were all winter coats. There was nothing like sexy kind of clothing, thank God, because I just wouldn't have known how to handle that at that point in my life. So they hired me, and I had to be back by 9:30 the next morning, and Norwalk to this factory. You know, it was a real trek. I had to go from my house in Norwalk to the train station, get a ride. The train itself was about an hour and 10 minutes. Came into Grand Central, and then I had to walk to the garment district. So probably I was getting up about 5, you know, to really get there. So I got there. It was very, very painful for me. For one thing, nothing in my shoe wardrobe could offset the pain of cement walking that I wasn't used to in New York. You know, I just had never done it, and probably was a person that would ultimately need some sort of list in the shoe or something, the right brand, you know, the whole thing. And I was young enough that I had never had to take care of this. So I got to March and Mendel. I remember the name of the factory, in agony, and then people from all over the country would start to come in, and they would need us models. They might use 2 models for 10 minutes, and then another 2, and then another 2. And basically, you took off one coat, and you put on another coat, and you walked up and down. It really wasn't hard work, but it was excruciating for me in the sense that I wasn't really at ease. And it's very interesting because some of the girls were so at ease. You know, this was nothing for them. They liked it. They joked around. They tried on different coats when no one was looking. You know, they had fun. And they were almost, I would say, raucous in their energy. And there was one girl that she was playing with what color she would make her hair. And she came in one day, and it was pitch black. And
oh,
it
wow.
looked great. It looked wonderful, and it was shiny. And it was like almost like I was 4 years old looking at an older sister. You know, these girls were so out of my league. They might not have gone to college. They might not even care about high school much. But they had a buzz to them that I didn't have. And whether that was because of living in Brooklyn, I don't know, rather than Norwalk, I don't know, or the expectations in their families. You know, that's the fascination of different groups and cultures. Anyway, I was struggling. And I and another girl were the first two fired. As soon as it got quieter and they didn't need as many girls, we were out. And I have to admit that I was very, very relieved, a tiny bit disappointed in myself, but so relieved. And the reason I bring it up, and that's kind of the end of that story, there's only one other tiny thing to bring up with it, and that is they let me know a few months later they were getting rid of certain amounts of coats, and I guess they got in touch with everyone who would work there, and we were allowed to come up. And for $10, I got a really beautiful winter coat, which was sort of like the skin of a sheep or something, but I probably was fake, but it was just stunning with great big loop buttons and, you know, oh, God, it was beautiful. And so that was the actual end of the story. And the reason I bring it up tied into transformation and vision is that it is okay to recognize and understand what isn't right for you and probably will never work. That's okay, and it doesn't mean you have to feel bad about yourself. So
right.
It was a very important lesson. Do you have anything comparable or similar or something you want to bring in around that type of concept?
Well, now that I'm getting older, I'm in my mid-60s, it is becoming clearer that many of the things I wanted to do when I, quote-unquote, retired, I'm not going to be able to do. I don't ambulate well as I did for my entire life. I used to love walking tremendous distances. And that's changed, and my balance isn't what it once was. So a lot of the adventures that I had envisioned for myself in my 60s and 70s just aren't going to happen. And also I've collected very many books over the years, and now I've become aware that there isn't enough time on this planet for me, even if I live for another 40 years or so, to read all these books. So I'm beginning to question why I'm still holding on to them if I'm not going to read them. It's just that dreams, even dreams that aren't of a grand nature, are difficult to let go of. And it's very hard, but then when you manage it, liberating to let go of them, because now it's one less weight that you're carrying on your shoulders. And I'm finding that now that I'm older, because a lot of the things I wanted to do in my life, I've done them, or I'm in the process of doing them now. So I don't have that sense of unfulfilled, I should have done something and I didn't, because I went ahead and did as much as I can do. And I'm pretty good at letting people know how I feel and what I think. So I don't really have very much, I guess, looking back on my life, it's unsaid. But it's just that it says that there isn't enough time left, even if I do exceptionally well with my health and live a much longer time than most, for me to do the things that I had wanted to do. So now it's a process of letting go before life forces me to let go. And But again, that's my experience.
Yeah, I can understand. I agree. I've had very similar parts in me that I've had to let go, and things that I thought, there were things that I thought when I was 20 that I was certain I was going to be able to handle. And one of them was doing an amazing amount of travel. And why I believe that was probably quite foolish, because it's not really the kind of stamina that I've had. It's not one of my strengths. you know, to be able to go to difficult places with perhaps strange foods and perhaps a place where you couldn't get your regular medicine if you needed it and so on. You know, I wasn't like a tiger girl, you know. Why I imagine this, I don't, you know, but I did, and I happened to have one summer that was absolutely amazing to me. And but, you know, I let me just review it because it's interesting and also has elements of transformation and vision, and that is that I got to go to Europe with a friend. She was in the same, actually, I should say I left Smith and I went to Barnard. And so I got to this amazing city, which New York is. And that was a very wise decision for me because I was able to tolerate and enjoy the energy that New York has. I really was. It was... I think I would have almost died in some part of me if I had stayed in a small school, you know, in a small town, that kind of thing. I really was ready for that kind of buzz that New York offered. And anyway, a friend, her father was a lawyer, and he specialized in law cases that would come up around folks on the oceans, and I don't really know fully. I can't say much else except in the lawsuit, you know, you meet people and you help them and stuff, and he sort of had a friend in every port kind of thing. So I couldn't have picked a better girl to go away with because her father literally set us up with families almost the whole way through. And that's a very different experience than being entirely just dropped somewhere. And we, you know, and we had some wonderful adventures, particularly in Greece, which always stayed in my mind as, isn't that interesting? Well, you're Greek. I mean, that, those 2.5 weeks, if they still can bring tears to my eyes and a feeling of a kind of sweet arousal. What I loved about being there is that people were very, very friendly. There was a sense of family. It's like suddenly belonging. I loved the family we stayed with, and they had friends and cousins, and they made sure that they took somebody took us swimming one day, and someone else drove us up into the mountains, and then, of course, we'd have a nap after lunch. You know, the world never should have given up that nap after lunch because it's perfect for the human body.
Yes.
You know, that, and even the stores even closed in those days, like 2 or 3 hours. And we met a girl from Greece, you know, a young girl our age, 20-ish, through this whole system. And I remember us sitting on the roof of her apartment house where she lived, out in the dark with the stars, talking about boys and marriage and, you know, just totally having this marvelous conversation. And she was already engaged, so she was well ahead of us and everything that she was planning and doing. And it was very interesting because the culture is somewhat different. And it was just, it was amazing. And I felt at home there much more than I felt at home. And I think that that's also something that ties into visionary experiences.
Yes.
Now, this particular vision, I don't think I've ever been able to reproduce it fully. You know, I know I would be happy in that kind of environment, But no, I haven't been able to really reproduce it except, you know, a weekend here or something mm-hmm. with a neighbor or whatever. But, and I think it's such a tragedy that the United States, at least in the Northeast where we live, doesn't lend itself to small communities, you know, that just have a sense of purpose and comfort and knowing each other, you know, that I experienced there. And so I guess the lesson in that, probably to work even harder than I have been able to, when you have a sense of vision around what you really need. But I don't want to be too punitive because lots of times we just can't. You know,
right.
We can't do everything. You were going to say something. Do you have something around this whole Greek decision talking about?
The Greek hospitality is world famous. It's called philoxenia, which means love of strangers or foreigners. And in antiquity, the Greeks didn't know who the stranger was. It could be a god. So just on the off case that you're a god, they treated strangers well. And there were all these stories about people who mistreated strangers or were rude to them or didn't offer them hospitality. And it turned out to be the gods, and the gods punished them by turning them into trees or or things like that. So the Greeks take hospitality very seriously to this day. Last time I was there, too, I was in Crete for a while, where the labyrinth is of the Minotaur and the Minoan civilization. And I don't have family down there, but people who didn't know me at all offered me the greatest of hospitality while I was on the island.
That's beautiful. How nice. Yeah. Did you had you spend time in Athens on any of your visits?
Yes, I've spent – Athens was the embarkation, disembarkation point for a lot of the airplanes at the time when I was in Greece.
Right.
So
Athens
and Piraeus, if we were going around by boat. So spent a lot of time in Athens. I spent a lot of time at the Parthenon, the Acropolis, Monastiraki, and all the other sites, the ancient Agora. I used to go there, and they used to engage in haggling. So if you wanted to buy something, they didn't have set prices, and they'd be very disappointed if you paid them a set price. They wanted to haggle because that was part of the fun. And buying, too.
Right. I don't know about that because I didn't buy anything of substance, but, yeah, that sounds interesting. And I think some of the countries do operate that way, and they get insulted if you just say, oh, okay, you're not supposed to say that, you know.
No.
You have to look upset and say, and touch it and smell it and say, you know, this isn't really worth more than blah, 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 you know.
Yeah, what are you crazy? You only want 10 drachmas for this?
Yeah.
You want 10 drachmas for this? It's definitely worth 2. I wouldn't give you more than 2, you know.
Right. So funny. And just to finish up on this this particular summer, the funniest thing, kind of mixed funny and kind of weird, was the only reason my father was willing to relinquish enough money for this summer trip was that he had ordered a Volvo car and I was to pick it up. A lot of people did that in those days for a foreign car. And if you picked it up, then you didn't have to pay certain taxes eventually. And anyway, so I was sent to pick it up in Sweden. I think it was Sweden. No, I'm not even sure now. But it was one of those countries wherever the Volvo was made. And I did eventually get to that country. It was toward the end of the vacation. I picked up the car, and I was astounded to see that it had not the 3-shift car, which I had had some training on, because I am old enough that when you learn to drive, they gave you a lesson with a stick shift, but I never really had one. This one had four sticks, not four sticks, but four positions you had to go through. And I didn't know anything about, I knew nothing about it, nothing. And here I am, you know, just a 19-year-old girl or 20 standing in the, you know, with the car stopped at a light in a street. how to move. I was scared to death. And, you know, the guys who gave me the car made it like, oh, you'll learn it in a block. It's not a problem, blah, blah, blah. But they did say, if you have to, return it and we'll drive it up to the port. And that's that. So
that's
I took
good.
It and somehow, yeah, but I'm not done with this yet. I stumbled through downtown and whatever. And along the way, I picked up a stranger, a young fellow about my age from, I forget what country. I think he was from Africa, actually. And we became friends. I don't know whether I treated him to a cup of tea in a store or whatever, but my intention was to have him drive. somehow we get out of town, and he wanted to see some sort of castle. It was about maybe 10 miles out, and I went along because he drove. You know, it was no problem to him. But once he was no longer in my life, which was a few hours later, I had to return the car. I just couldn't. I could have been in an accident. You know, I haven't had the range of practice you need. So I returned it. Okay. So jumping ahead to when that car arrived in New York, we now have one of the worst things that almost happened but didn't with my father and myself, because he was a stickler for money and doing what you're supposed to do. And so I had to now go to New Jersey to pick up the car. Okay. So that was my job because I got the 10 weeks in Europe. You know, I had to pay back and the family. In a way it was good. You know, I mean, I knew he loved me without failing. But I mean, I think his strictness and his attitude wasn't bad when I look over the whole picture, you know? But anyway, I had to go and get that car. And okay, so no one was going to take me. I had to take the car. I had to take the train into New York, go to my room at the college where I could stay overnight, and then proceed to New Jersey. And then I found that, you know, I don't know, I guess I took a bus to the port. And then I see that there's this giant line that you have to stand in. And I had some papers with me, but not much. And this line, you know, I could see that they're asking all these questions that I wasn't even prepared for before they're relinquishing cars to people. So when I got up to the front of the line, I was unfortunate to realize that these guys had not driven the car. They probably put it on a truck with other cars. It had not gone to 750 miles. We now owed hundreds of dollars in taxes, which I did not have with me. I had the check to pay the remainder on the car, but that was it. So I did the only thing that any decent, creative young girl could do. I started to cry. And it worked. The cop said, all right, that's it. You can go. Honestly. So, you know. I don't know what I would have done. I mean, I can't even imagine how my father would have handled it, but I would have been in big trouble. So, yeah, Yeah. So all of these adventures come together so that I think by your late teens or your early 20s, you do have a sense of who you are and what you're good at, but you may not understand how you have to work it yet. And so a lot of my work, my books for girls, my original book, The Enchanted Self, A Positive Therapy, and then the two books, Secrets and The Truth, they all have aspects of how to define what really makes us us, and then how we can play with that and move it into really the right visions of ourselves and not waste our time on earth. And the simplest thing that I have developed that I'll go into now a little bit is taking the time to understand your own potential, because your parents, I don't care how great they are and how much they love you, or your grandparents or your favorite teacher, no one will take the time or can truly recognize your potential as well as you can, because it's too delicate. It's almost like, you know, a bird sitting in a nest. The mother's waiting till the thing cracks open. Nobody knows exactly where to sit on that egg except the mother. It's just too complicated. Mm-hmm. And there's jealousy in families and sibling rivalry and lack of money or too much money, or, you know, somebody doesn't want you to move away for college and you should move away, whatever it is. You can't find a job. The only way to really solve some of this is to get in touch with what you think your real potential is. So if you felt at 7 like you really wanted to play the piano and nobody encouraged this, either because you had no piano, you had no family, had no money for lessons, or maybe your older sister was getting the lessons on the piano and that's all the, you know, that's where it was going to stop. But if that was something that had a good feeling for you and you feel deprived, that's something to remember on your to-do list about your life. It's a to-do list about life that you're compiling. And eventually it can have on it things that you would still like to do, things you don't want to do, things you can't do, things that maybe you'll consider. And a lot of the maybe you'll consider would tie into the things like around aging that both of us have had to experience. You know, you may have loved skiing, but your ankles aren't so good anymore. But that doesn't mean there might not be a sledding hobby that you could still do, or just, you might be able to walk on, what do you call it when you just walk? Snowshoes. I mean, there might be a variety of things that could replace heavy-duty skiing, or just enjoying the fresh air and, you know, if you have enough money, going to a hotel that, instead of you getting exhausted on the trails, you're going to use their gym, take a quick swim, and have a hot chocolate.
Uh-huh.
It's not so bad. It's not so bad. It's all a matter of adapting to the potential as it shifts and changes. So that's why I say, my visionary work ties into specifically the films and the psychology, so we can talk a little about that. But the general visionary work for all of us that we all need to do over a lifetime ties into our potential that will only get pointed out now and then and won't be recognized necessarily by anybody except you when it happens. And just like you and I recognize when May Eisenberg welcomed us to do shows and be guests, I think each of us knew in the pit of our stomach, that's for me, that's waiting for me. You know, no, but no one else would have really told us. I mean, she would have gone on and found someone else.
Yes.
In whatever, she would have.
She was thinking of retiring at that point. So she was very grateful that we stepped up the plate and offered to pay for some of the airtime and develop our own shows.
Yeah. So she put a, you know, she lit the candle, but we had to be aware that it was right. And that's why I'll go now just on to why is this filmmaker Life magazine so exciting for me and the article they wrote. It is because I have been working on the potential in people for probably 40 years and working more specifically on it for the 20 to 25 years around the book, when the book, The Enchanted Self, A Positive Therapy, came out. And the ways that I've worked on this, there are two visionary opportunities that I have jumped into. One is that when I started in my practice as a psychologist and I was seeing private patients, I came to realize that psychologists and all professionals in the field, nurses, psychiatrists, counselors, we were all asking a lot of the wrong questions, because the questions should have been much more, what's right with you and what are your talents and when was the best time you had in your life and how could we remake that type of feeling and what can you do, what would work for you, rather than what are your problems? I'll just sit back in my chair and make notes and you tell me everything that's wrong with you. Well, that's not very inviting, particularly when you're not so thrilled you even have to go for counseling, a lot of times people felt worse walking out of an office than walking in. And I started to write about this, and I kept notes on my clients, and I always started to ask them, not when I say hello, sit down, but, you know, say 15 minutes at least in the first visit, now I want you to tell me about some of the best times you've ever had. And I want to tell me when you were most excited and felt you had really thrived. And even if we are back in first grade, I don't care. You know, just let's get it out and see the feelings and the thoughts that go with it. And I always did that, and I still do it. My practice is much more geared to a smaller practice, and I'm not at the point of discovery, but that's built into what I'm looking for with a client is, where's the good news? Because the good news often is what will help them get well. And I think you know that 100%.
Yeah.
You've always worked that way. You want to say anything about the way you work? Perfect moment.
I've always recognized the potential in people too, and I didn't want to go through the whole, what are your problems? I noticed very early on in the hospitals and other institutions where I worked, was that people got so conditioned to telling their problems and especially what their medication is, that anybody could ask them and they would automatically rattle it off without thought as to the implications of sharing this information with people who weren't in the therapeutic community. So
right.
I focus on the positive too. And as a result of that, I used to get the difficult, quote-unquote, cases in one of the hospitals where I worked. And I remember there were a couple of people. One person was given to me, and it was said that he was, like, very primitive, and he only could say his name in a few words. And I discovered by working with him that he might not be able to speak, or he might choose not to speak. But some of the comic book characters he liked, which I saw because he was reading a comic book, if he was pretending to be those characters, he could talk quite eloquently. It took about a year, and eventually he as himself was able to talk as eloquently as his characters. But everyone believed that he couldn't talk. And then I remember they gave me a young man who thought he was a crystal intelligence, that he wasn't biological at all. And somebody else who made strange sounds instead of talking. And I remember the strange sounds. I recognized them as sound effects from Star Wars. So I would think when he made the sound effect, where in the movie Star Wars was that sound effect? He was conveying very complex emotions by making these sounds if you knew Star Wars, or if you had Star Wars handy. And there's another Viking ships and things like that. And because I knew Norse mythology and Viking history, I could tell that she was communicating in kennings. You know, she was talking about things in Viking poetry and how they express things. And to somebody who wasn't aware of Viking poetry, it sounded, you know, very bizarre. But if you understood
what
they were communicating, that they were actually being very poetic. And so I started doing things like that. And again, I'm a very different, I guess I'm neurodivergent, they would call it now. You know, I grew up being able to experience things telepathically and clairvoyantly and clairaudiently, which to most people would sound like I'm hallucinating all the time. But in the tradition where I was raised from Greece, people believed in those things. So it was part of an active belief system.
Mm-hmm.
And I got, like I would tell them out in America, they don't believe in the evil eye and things like that. And their answer was, well, Americans are either stupid or they're spiritually blind because they can't see these things.
I got to see the reality.
A matter of consensus that reality, we could be living the same reality, but because we're describing it differently and perceiving it slightly differently, that, you know, we can't communicate with another. So I made an extra effort to communicate with people and see what they meant, and also to find out what their dreams for their best self was, for the most fulfilled self.
Right.
Instead of what can't you do and why can't you do it? And, you know, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, yes.
And I reacted to it also.
So where did I leave off now? I'm getting close to my bedtime. Let me think. Where were we? So as far as this, I lost the last thought.
You were talking about how basically with your patients, you try to focus on the positive things as well as.
I got it. Right.
Okay.
So what happened was the whole world finally was picking up on that, and two or three years later, positive psychology, actually called positive psychology, existed now. And there were some scholars and professors from top universities that were designing ways of helping people become closer to their positive aspects of themselves and recognize their own talents. And it was becoming a legitimate stream within psychology. Now, for me, there was good and bad in this. I was very thankful on a general level that the corrections were starting to be made. But in a way, it was sad because I had made so many corrections and really written a very thorough, deep casebook before anybody else, at least for as far as books for women in positive psychology, and had some thoughts that were really, really very ahead of the time between a patient and psychologist, in the sense of the amount of wear and tear psychologically on the psychologist or the counselor through having to work, you know, in the field of mind, where many dark things and moods and memories come out. And I also felt that people who work in these fields were not taking good enough care of themselves.
Right.
Now, I didn't go on to write a I didn't write a book about it. I wrote some articles and kind of left it at that, because, again, if we're going to go with our own visions and transformations, I wasn't going to give the time, you know, to also completely go into the study of the caregiver. So that was one transformation and vision that was part of my life. And the other one happened much more recently. It happened 8 years ago when I had the opportunity to take a script I had written about a young girl and her coming of age issues, which I had already had in a small book called The Truth, I'm a Girl, I'm Smart, and I Know Everything. And I was working with it. I had turned it into a play with the help of a wonderful, talented man who works in the field of local drama in Monmouth County, who took the time to help me even know how to write a play. But it was all leading up like an arrow being shot off toward what came to be known as selfie filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, selfie filmmaking is low on the list. If you look on Google, it's, you know, it doesn't take up a lot of space. But I do believe that over the next 10, 20, 30 years, because the smartphones have become more and more refined and able to do so much, there will be beautiful films made with nothing but a smartphone.
Right.
And there will be, you know, it'll be, actually it's going to push out some of the other cameras and stuff. There'll be some wars. But in terms of the type of work I do, which is trying to help people understand the coming of age problems that we all go through and are particularly bad, like after the pandemic and kids sitting in their rooms and stuff, and the depression and the sadness, and a lot of the boys and girls, and, you know, even worse, you can use selfie filmmaking to help bring the health back to these kids. They can make their own movies as assignments. They can do little plays. You know, they can do so much. It's like suddenly crayons were discovered, you know? And I'm pretty much, you know, I was ahead of the crowd with selfie filmmaking films that I've made, where they have at least one cat girl in it who does a lot of her own scenes, picks her clothing, puts on her makeup, decides what room of the house to sit in or stand in or the yard. And she's a filmmaker at 14. And these films have done really well. They've been in almost 200 festivals at this point. And I've won a lot of prizes.
Oh,
yes, no
yes.
money. My husband will be quick to tell you, but, you know, it's hard. Money is a whole nother level. And some people have a lot more vision and transformation with money than I do. That's another story. But it's worth every penny I put in, because
definitely
these films have helped people. They've helped people. And parents, you know, when I've seen, when I've had a chance to be at a festival where the parents and, you know, adults are watching the films, and I can see in their comments later how they can say their hearts were, like, open to just even be brought back to the first love, or having to move, and the loneliness they felt, and, you know, the different parts of growing up that you've got to make it through. So, you know, it's good to learn how, and it's good to make the most of it. And so that's how I became a visionary. And I hope this show tonight will leave people a little more courageous and interested in doing their own vision work, you know, which there's lots of ways to do it with vision boards and sitting and meditating, or going for a walk and just slowing down and looking at things. But I think it's a very important factor in the way we handle ourselves. And I think that's about all I have to say.
As always, you're giving us lots to think about and meditate upon. Yes, I'm envisioning now my older years, and because I've done this throughout my life, you know, just kind of like imagine what, you know, what I'd like to see there, and then how can I bring this about? Not quickly, maybe, but eventually. And I'm finding that there are more ideas that are floating around out there than I had thought. So it'll be a lot easier than I anticipated.
Good.
So visionary work is very important. And thank you so very much for giving us your thoughts on visionary work. And also, again, Positive Human Services, you're a pioneer, very creative, very awesome. And I'm very honored to have been working with you on and off throughout the decades.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. It's great. And I'll just mention that if you want to know more about any of my films, my work, my books, just jump on to EnchantedSelf.com, and you'll see a lot of stuff. And you want to be in touch with me, that's great, Barbara.Holstein@gmail.com. And as I've said before, I answer everyone unless you sound weird or scary. I might not answer. So if it's genuine, I answer. Something
thank
I
you
feel
so very
committed
much,
to do.
Say hi to Russell, and thank you.
You
so very
I
much.
Will.
Hour a lot, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Yes, and feel good. Bye-bye
thank
for
you.
Now.
Bye-bye, and thank you to all our wonderful guests who tuned in, whether you're here live listening through our audio, or whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, or whether you check out our programs on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Good night, everybody, and thanks again, Barbara.